Welcome to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast. Every 2 weeks, we explore news and issues affecting hunters, anglers, and conservation across the northeastern United States. If you enjoy the content here, be sure to subscribe to our print or digital versions by calling 800-535-5191 or visit our website at outdoornews.com. Now, here's your host and a man who claims he's immune to buck fever, New York Outdoor News editor Dan Ladd.
This episode of the Great Northeast Podcast is brought to you by the Family Forest Carbon Program, a collaborative initiative created by two nonprofit organizations, the American Forest Foundation and the Nature Conservancy, assisting landowners in improving the health of their land with long-term sustainable forest management practices while providing guaranteed annual income. Learn more at familyforestcarbon.org. Greetings and welcome to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. As always, happy to be along and especially happy to have you along as we're really starting to look spring outdoor activities right in the face. And that's a great, great thing. Obviously, I'm talking about turkey hunting. In the previous episode, we talked a lot about turkey hunting. We're going to pick up that topic again today. Kind of as a continuation of what we were doing in the last episode of the podcast, episode 94, where we were doing some turkey calls. A few things I didn't go over there on that podcast that I just want to touch on real quick. But before we get into all that, I just want to talk about some things going on here in New York and around the Northeast. Obviously, spring is kicking in and it's turkey season, but it's also fishing season. And here in New York, we're going to have a whole bunch of fishing, freshwater fishing seasons reopening on May 1st. Walleyes, northern pike, tiger muskies, pickerel. It'll be a while before we get into the muskie season, the bass season. Muskie is, I believe, June 1st statewide, and bass is, of course, June 15th. But there's catch and release in most, but not all of New York. So wherever you are, whatever state you're in, hopefully you're getting a chance to get out there and wet a line, and hopefully you've got some seasons about to open and you're enjoying yourself. Here in New York, there's been a lot of talk about deer. I just want to touch on that real quick. In the northern zone, there is legislation in the state legislature, obviously, to perhaps allow DEC to expand the issuance of antlerless deer permits, doe permits, in Region 5 of the northern zone. Now, they currently do so in Region 6, but they don't have the authority to do that in Region 5, and they need legislation passed to allow that. Mixed feelings on that from a lot of people, but it does, they do have the authority in half of the region. And what would they do with the other half? My guess is probably the same thing. Of course, that ties in with a whole bunch of proposals being put forth right now, including shooting a doe to earn a second buck tag here in New York. The big thing is we've been seeing a lot on social media with this, and that's good. But we certainly hope that hunters are weighing their opinions with the Department of Environmental Conservation. You have until May 17th to do that. So just go to DEC's website, Fish and Wildlife, look it up. Or you can visit the many articles we've written about it on outdoornews.com/New York. And you'll find the links. There's also in their DEC's press release area. Either way, make sure your feelings are known to DEC. Hey, one of the things I didn't cover was a couple of different calls that I like to do when I'm calling turkeys very first thing early in the morning on the roost. We're going to get to that as well as we're going to check in with folks over in Vermont. That's the highlight of the day, actually, because they are celebrating the restoration of the wild turkey over there, a program that's gone on just a little less longer than here in New York. And they just had a big big celebration of that in West Paulette, New York, where the first turkeys were released in Vermont back in the late 60s. And eventually that obviously led to a hunting season. I was there to check that out. I'm going to share some of the highlights along with talking about some turkey calling techniques for the roost when we come back right after this.
Are you an avid angler searching for the latest fishing news and tips? It's time to check out OutdoorNews.com. Get ready to reel in the freshest updates and expert advice from top anglers. Plus, you'll have access to the most up-to-date fishing reports, lake maps, lake reports, and more. Don't let the big one get away. Join OutdoorNews.com and reel in a world of fishing knowledge and expertise. Join today, OutdoorNews.com. Your passion, your news, your fishing journey.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. And I've got a turkey call in my hand again, just like our previous podcast a few weeks ago. I realized, and of course, a couple of people asked me a few questions that I didn't touch on a few topics during that episode, and I just want to do that really briefly here. And actually, it's a key strategy of mine, and there's no guarantee that if you roost a bird the night before or if you're working a bird that's on the roost that you're going to get that bird to come to you. There's so many variables. Are there hens around? Are there other gobblers around? Is there a flock of jakes around? There's so many things that can influence that bird, but you can influence them too if you're trying to get them in close. And this is just a few strategies of mine. I learned these from a couple of real seasoned turkey hunters. One of my favorites is a guy named Bill Hollister, who is he was a legend, still is here in New York State, and did a ton of hunting. He worked for DEC. We've had him on the podcast, and he does some real serious stuff in the morning to get birds to come in. He's highly successful. Of course, Bill was big on owl hooting, which I did last week. And of course, that's a locator technique. A lot of times I don't have the opportunity to roost birds, as I said previously. So when I get to the woods in the morning or the field where I suspect birds to be lurking, I let out a good owl hoot. I do a hoo, 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 and I do that good and loud. And of course, sometimes that triggers other owls and they'll do the same. So I've got a bird roosted. He's calling on the roost. Maybe there's one or two. What am I going to do next? Well, the one thing I'm listening for is hens. I'm really keeping my ears open to find out if there's hens around, and I'm hoping there's not. It's always beneficial if there aren't hens, but unfortunately, that's not always the case. So my philosophy is to make sure that I am the first hen that the gobblers that I'm trying to call to hear. So you hear people talk a lot about a tree call, and a tree call is just that. It's a sound that hens make while they're in the trees. It's just a very, very soft yelp. Now, I have a box call in my hand, and usually I do the tree calls on a slate call because they're just a little easier to scratch. And of course, if somebody has a mouth call, I'm terrible with mouth calls. That's why you're not seeing me demo them. But if you're using a mouth call, of course, it's real easy to control your volume there. But a tree call is just, you know, some really, really soft yelps, like a, even just a couple of them. Really soft, but yet loud enough that that bird can hear you. If I do a tree call and a gobbler answers, that's it. I'm putting the call down until he's on the ground. Until he flies down, by that I mean. I'm not calling a lot. I'm not yelping a lot while the birds are on the roost. That's about the only calling I do. Now, I had another friend of mine that I hunted with for many years who wouldn't touch a call, period, until the gobblers had flown down. He wanted to make sure they were on the ground before he called to them. I'm not so much of that persuasion to a degree because I'm going to share one more call with you that I will do if I know there's hens in the area, or if I want to act like I'm a hen. I do this a lot, and it's tough because trying to time it, and this is kind of knowing your turkeys, because you got to do this before they fly down, but you don't want to do it too early on. It's got to be light enough that turkeys want to fly down. And what this is it's a fly down cackle. If you've ever heard a hen make this sound, they'll cackle when they fly down, and it's this is going to be loud, so I apologize in advance for that. But this is a call that I do a lot. Then the other thing I do right after this call is I take my hat or a glove or something and I beat it against my thigh to sound like a bird flying down. And then the other thing I may do shortly after that is scratch some leaves if they're around. But the fly down cackle is really big because it tells a bird that a hen just flew down. And not only that, he hears that. He knows where she is. So it can really trigger them to come looking for him. And I've kind of had better luck with this call when there's more than one gobbler. It seems like they'll come together. They'll come in together looking for this hen. Well, here's how it sounds. Just like that. Again, that call is not chalked up, so it could be a little better sounding. I just kind of grabbed it before I flipped on the mic here. But that's a fly-down cackle. And again, I like to do that if I want to imitate a hen flying down. Literally, again, it's timing. It's all about doing it at the right time. And if you wait too late and the birds are on the ground, well, maybe if they fly down, as soon as they fly down, you could do that if you think the gobbler's on the ground and he just flew down. but you don't want to wait too long and you don't want to do it too early. It's, again, it's a timing thing. And it's about knowing your birds and knowing the sound. A lot of times a gobbler will gobbler as soon as he hits the ground, and it'll sound different than it did in the tree. And if you didn't get the fly down in, then that's a perfect time to do it, in my opinion. That's what's worked for me. That's all I'm saying. I'm not telling anyone how to hunt or what to do. I'm just telling you that's something I've done, and it usually does pique some sort of curiosity among birds, and it seems to get them to come looking. So a couple of soft tree calls, you know, while they're in the trees. Again, be the first hen that gobbler hears. He knows you're there. He might hear other hens. He might even be able to see them. But he still knows that there's a hen over there. I just heard her. And then when you do the fly down cackle, that tells him she's on the ground over there, and she's probably feeding over there, and hopefully he'll want to go have a look and see what's happening. So those are a couple of my early morning strategies right on the roost that I didn't share in the previous episode, and I apologize for that. But we hope you enjoyed that episode. We're able to take something from it. It kind of encouraged me to be practicing my turkey calling a little bit more. And as the final days approach here, as we lead up to May 1st, getting ready for the season, I am doing something that I said I would be doing in the previous episode, and that is just driving around and contacting landowners and making sure the places to hunt have some birds around, doing a little scouting. I haven't been in the woods too much, a little bit of walking around. I got a trail camera out in one of my locations, and I'll check that next week right prior to the season to see if there's any toms around. That's in the woods, and I put it right on a trail. And one of the things I learned from the great Tom Kelly, late 90s now, the author of The 10th Legion, a book they just republished, is he always says, never turn your back on a road. And I learned that lesson the hard way a couple times. And what he means by that is turkeys like to take the easy route. They like to walk roads. They like to walk paths, logging roads. Doesn't mean they'll veer off of them. In fact, sometimes I've seen them get to the area where they heard you calling, and they'll get close to where they think that hen is, and they'll be looking, and they'll go off the road and into the woods and maybe circle. I've seen them do that many times, but I've also had them come walk right down a road. And I've had hens come walking right down the road towards a decoy on their own, and sometimes bring in the boyfriend with them. So these are all things to keep in mind. You can never have too many tactics, too many things in your arsenal when it comes to turkey hunting. And it never hurts to try. If something isn't working, try something else. With that, I wish everyone some good luck out there in the woods when you get out there, whether you're hunting already or been traveling around a little bit, or you're getting ready to hunt some of the northeastern states that are going to be opening around May 1st here. Please be safe, especially very safe, and don't pull that trigger unless you know it's a real live gobbler. He's got a beard. That's the law. Be sure of your target. And of course, with turkey hunting, beyond. Hey, we're going to come right back with some great information in celebration of the wild turkey heritage in the state of Vermont right after this.
There's a great program available for youth who love to hunt and fish. It's called the Outdoor News Junior Pro Team, and any youth 18 or under can join for free at jrproteam.com. JPT program showcases useful videos and tips to help encourage the next generation to become stronger anglers and hunters. It's a platform to celebrate and inspire those outdoor loving youth. Check out the photos of Outdoor News Junior Pro Team members on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. And visit our jrproteam.com for more information.
Welcome back to the Great Northeast Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Ladd, editor of New York Outdoor News. And on April 18th, I took a ride over to western Vermont, literally just a couple hundred yards from the Vermont border, a little community called West Paulette. It was there that in the late 1960s, they released the first turkeys in Vermont, like New York. And some of those birds did come from New York. But like New York, they experienced some great success with the expansion of the wild turkey into the farmlands and eventually the woodlands. So much so that they caught turkeys in Vermont, transferred them to other parts of the state, other states, Ontario. We've got that story. We're going to kick it off right now with Vermont Fish and Wildlife Commissioner Jason Batchelor.
And I am the Commissioner of Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I have to include how lucky I feel today to be in these shoes. The commissioner of the day doesn't always get to do something so monumental. I'm from Elmore, Vermont, and thank you all for choosing to spend this day with us as we celebrate the restoration of Vermont's treasured wild turkey. Now, restoration attempts don't always go as planned. While Vermont has had a great success with peregrine falcons, loons, bald eagles, and others, you can look around the country and see attempts that have not succeeded. Red wolves, woodland caribou, and even turkey restoration did not always go as planned. But before we can criticize, we must walk a mile in their shoes, as we say. I especially like this tactic because when I eventually do criticize, I'm over a mile away and I have their shoes. As you can see, this event has drawn some extraordinary folks. Those that I have mentioned, and if you can believe it, Mr. John Hathaway, the man who bagged the very first turkey here, of the 23 that were taken in that historic 12-day hunting season in 1973. We also have Mr. Donald Gaudette, who took the first turkey in the third season. If you gents want to raise your hands, I'm sure folks would like to meet you afterwards. Thank you so much. I'd like to acknowledge with great appreciation the private landowners and the farmers who welcomed this project during the first releases. The Malcolms from just up the road for one, and the late state representative Robert Graff, whose land in North Rupert was, according to local knowledge there, one of another site of one of the releases. I'd also like to acknowledge Bill Drake, who was Vermont's turkey biologist when the wild turkey restoration began. In 1969, John Hall helped Bill stock our first turkeys near Pollitt. On February 28th, two toms, and March 4th, five hens. Bill trap netted the wild turkeys in southwestern New York and released a total of 31 near Pollitt and Castleton in 1969 and 1970. John Hall works for us to this day. And while he couldn't be here because he's taking care of his wife, he is a treasured member of our outreach team and responsible for the photos of the birds you see on your invitations. I would like to acknowledge the support of Tom Decker from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Conservation Aid and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a whole, who facilitated the acquisition of our marker through the NSSF, the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and Mr. John McNamara, who you'll hear from in a bit. I'd like to acknowledge the firearms, archery, and ammunition manufacturers for their funding support for wildlife conservation projects like this, especially our wild turkey program. You may not know this, because we hunters like to take all the credit, but 76% of federal funding benefiting conservation comes from excise taxes on guns and archery equipment and ammunition. Shooters, right? So thank you so much. But hunters deserve extraordinary credit for the biological data they provide. They are the eyes and ears on the landscape, and the support to the hunting effort here at home and worldwide is incalculable. I'd like to acknowledge the National Wild Turkey Federation and our Vermont chapter president, Mr. Brett Ledoux, and many other partner conservation organizations that enable our wildlife conservation successes. While our department does outstanding work, our success is entirely related to the commitment of many partners working together. And lastly, I'd like to acknowledge the Fish and Wildlife Board. There are many here, some past, some present, and their dedication to ensuring effective and enjoyable hunting seasons. This citizen legislature, appointed by the governor, set seasons, methods, and limits with which the department manages the flock, and we couldn't do it without them. I've got a list of folks who I'll be very proud to introduce. The next is my boss, Secretary Julie Moore, who's gonna say a few words. Julie's responsible for me being here, and I owe her a debt of gratitude for allowing me to be the commissioner of the day. She's a huge supporter of Fish and Wildlife, and I'll turn it over to her.
So, good afternoon, everyone. It is really lovely to be here today, and it couldn't be nicer. Thrilled for the opportunity to be part of a celebration dedicating a conservation marker, but also a celebration of one of Vermont's great wildlife success stories, the restoration of the wild turkey. And this is a story really worth telling. Back in 1968, the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department began identifying the places that might best support these birds, including right here in Pollitt. By the spring of 1973, just a handful of years later, that work had paid off. The population of Vermont's wild turkeys had grown from those original few dozen birds to an estimated 500 or 600. And department biologists have kept at it, monitoring, translocating birds to new parts of the state, and working alongside hunters and volunteers to protect, restore, and manage prime habitat. By the 1980s, Vermont had so many turkeys, we were actually able to share birds with other states and help get their programs off the ground, which is a pretty amazing accomplishment. Today, we have an estimated 45,000 wild turkeys calling Vermont home, which is a pretty remarkable number. Vermont's wild turkey population is now on par with the population of Vermont's largest city, Burlington. I'm sure there's a joke there. But here's the thing. Behind those 45,000 birds are as many, if not more, landowners who made a choice to manage their land thoughtfully, to be good neighbors to wildlife, and to be a steward of this place we're all lucky enough to call home. And so my thanks to all of you for your role in this success. The wild turkey's return isn't just a biology story. It's a Vermont story. It's these thousands of quiet individual acts of stewardship, repeated season after season across every corner of the state. No single person, department, or agency made this happen. You all did. Of course, the work doesn't stop here. Habitat protection and management remain the foundation of healthy wildlife populations. Climate change, invasive species, new diseases, and fragmented landscapes are real pressures on Vermont's wildlife. And meeting them will require the same spirit of public participation and private commitment that brought the turkey back. We need landowners, hunters, volunteers, and partners watching, reporting, and continuing to work alongside us. This marker will stand as a reminder of what this sort of collaboration can achieve.
Your land is your legacy, but keeping it healthy and thriving means caring for it now and in the future. The Family Forest Carbon Program can help you do right by your land with guaranteed income, help developing a forest management plan, and advice from experts. If you own 30 acres or more of forest land in Vermont, Massachusetts, or New York, you may be eligible to enroll in the Family Forest Carbon Program. Visit familyforestcarbon.org and enroll today.
And now it's my real pleasure to introduce my boss, Governor Phil Scott. The governor has been a steadfast champion of the public-private conservation model that makes Vermont, Vermont. Since January 2017, when the governor took office, he supported the voluntary conservation of nearly 32,000 additional acres in Vermont, protected in fee or with easements, and while never losing sight of the role private landowners play in keeping Vermont's landscape whole. So he's a partner in this work in the truest sense of the word. Please join me in welcoming the governor.
Thank you, Julie, and thanks for everyone for being here today. It's really great to be in this region to mark this important site, reflect on how we got here, and maybe talk a little turkey. Now, I've used that term a lot over my life, but I thought I'd better look it up to see what it really means so I don't get myself into trouble. This is what Google says. Google says that to talk turkey is to stop speaking in useless, unfair, or buzzard terms, and to start talking truthfully. Now, after spending a week in the State House, I have a renewed appreciation for the term. That being said, I do want to say publicly how fortunate you are to have the Rutland delegation looking out for you in the State House. Many of them are here today, and if you could just raise your hand so everyone can see you, we thank you so much for your service. Thank you. So with this new term that I learned, they talk turkey every single day in the State House. And in my opinion, we need a few more of them in the building. Chris Pritchard is a part of that group. Very much appreciated. And I want to thank him for helping to put this event together and bringing, it appears, half your family. How about the family members here, Chris Pritchard? Family and friends, how about raising your hand? There you go. Now, I've lived in Vermont all my life. I was born and raised in Barrie, now live in Berlin. So I didn't go far, at least geographically. Admittedly, though, there are times when I find myself taking for granted how lucky we are to live here in Vermont. Like, it's true. You know, we complain a lot about Vermont and maybe the taxes and so forth, but there's no place I'd rather live, no place I intend to live than Vermont. Like many of you, I spent a lot of my youth in the woods, hunting, fishing, and exploring. And unfortunately these days, I don't get to spend anywhere near the time I used to enjoying the outdoors. But when I do, it's incredible to see the results of conservation successes and all the wildlife I didn't see in my youth, but can now see within a quarter mile of my home, and most of the time, right in my backyard. Loon, bear, coyote, Canadian geese, moose, osprey, bald eagles, snapping turtles, and of course, turkeys. It's truly remarkable that just over the last 50 years or so, we've been able to increase the population and health of our wildlife through efforts like the one we celebrate today. When I was a kid, the only turkeys we saw were around Thanksgiving at the local grocery store. And now we're at a point where we see them all across the state. I know there are some who think the Department of Fish and Wildlife exists only to issue hunting and fishing licenses. But there's so much more than that. They're rooted in science, on a mission to protect our land, our wildlife, and our way of life. And for that, they deserve our thanks. But I also want to reflect on a common theme we've already heard a couple times today. I want to thank the landowners in particular for being excellent stewards of the environment and for allowing us to access their property, to hike, to hunt, bike, snowshoe, snowmobile, and fish. Without their support, Vermont wouldn't be what it is today, and we wouldn't have nearly the options for recreation we do. So it's really, really important for us to let them know how much we appreciate their generosity. So let's continue to support all this work together, because we all have a role to play. So thanks again for having me, but also for doing this amazing work. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Governor Scott. I'd like to introduce Lieutenant Governor John Rogers.
Thank you, Jason, and I really want to thank Chris. It's been a wonderful day down here. We went up to the Keogh Conservation Camp, and there must have been 70 or 80 kids there doing turkey calls, and I told those kids I hadn't seen that many turkeys since I got out of the State House on Friday. But it's so great to see young people that are interested in being out in nature, because I think that's part of the problem with humanity today is a whole bunch of folks don't get out in nature enough. This turkey story is so unbelievable. You know, you guys were hunting them down here, and we still didn't have any up in the Northeast Kingdom where I live. And I remember I saw my first one back in the 90s, and when I saw it, having never seen a turkey in the wild, I was like blown away. But then it didn't fly. It took off running and covered like 100 yards in 2 seconds and was gone. And it left me thinking, did I really just see a turkey? It was just so amazing to go from that point in the 90s to now it's the most prevalent game species that I see. I saw one this morning on my way out, and he was probably 150, 200 yards from me. I was taking the dogs out for a walk, and as soon as I opened the door, that thing booked for the woods. It was gone. And so I had all these friends who told me, you know, you should really take up turkey hunting. I never did it. I deer hunted, rabbit hunted. And I said, how hard can it be? I have to stop the car so I don't run the stupid things over. But those of you who hunt know when you step out of the car, game on. The things are so sharp, their eyesight, they catch movement and they're gone. It's amazing. And so I have a group of friends who I met in my work in state government in the State House, one of them being the former Fish and Wildlife Commissioner, One of them is a former Forest Parks and Rec commissioner, a journalist, a couple lobbyists, and they come up to go turkey hunting with me for a weekend every year. And so far, out of 7 years, I think they've killed one turkey. So now I call it Turkey Conservation Weekend. And so what I'm going to do next year is bring them down and have the kids teach them how to call turkeys. But this is a true success. And as a couple other speakers said, so much of the thanks goes to the landowners, the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Without the landowners, you know, we don't have the great hunting and fishing. We don't have the wildlife habitat. And I think a lot of folks in the State House in Montpelier that forget what makes Vermont special is not just the working lands. We hear that word over and over again, working lands, and it's super important. But we don't have working lands if we don't have the people who are working those lands. And if we don't have those people, we're no longer Vermont. And I know so many people who fish and hunt that spend time putting in wildlife food plots. They spend time releasing wild apple trees. They're out helping Fish and Wildlife do the moose surveys. And all of those things that make our Fish and Wildlife Department great and make our herds so great. Personally, at home, I keep anywhere from 20 to 40 acres a year, depending on how much time I have. I set aside a huge amount for grassland bird species. I still have bobolinks and woodcocks and field sparrows and all that, and put in a broad section of food for pollinators and wildlife, and it is just amazing. I love to hunt, but more than loving to hunt, I love to see that wildlife. When I got up this morning, there were turkeys out, there were deer out, there were birds all over the place. We live in a really spectacular place, but let's just remember the working lands and the people who work them really are what make this place special. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor.
What you just heard was some of the dignitaries from the state of Vermont, the governor, the lieutenant governor, commissioner, secretary of Fish and Wildlife, all kinds of dignitaries were there, and a bunch of biologists, and it went on and on and on. It was quite a display of folks. And if you want to catch more on that, look up the Paulette Wild Turkey Restoration Dedication, April 18th, 2026 on YouTube. There's probably an hour's worth of interviews there, including some from the biologists, just a whole bunch of really good stuff. With that, we're hoping everyone's got a big fish in their net, and maybe a big gobbler hanging from a tree or in display you're fanning out. For the Great Northeast Podcast and New York Outdoor News, I'm Dan Ladd.
Missed a past episode of the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast? You can find previous programs at outdoornews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platform. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover on this program, get yourself a subscription to Outdoor News. Simply call 800-535-5191 or visit us at outdoornews.com. And don't forget to join us again here in 2 weeks to talk everything out of doors. Thanks for listening to the New York Outdoor News Great Northeast Podcast.